What's up, y'all? It's your girl Sarai from the Freaky as Fuck podcast, and I don't think I have to tell y'all that I am a huge fan and collector of all things spooky and macabre. And if you're like me, then might I recommend checking out Hell Yeah Voodoo Dolls? This incredible online shop has one-of-a-kind handcrafted voodoo dolls, handmade jewelry, and all kinds of Hell Yeah merch, such as hoodies, t-shirts, beanies, and more. If you're looking to get a unique gift for yourself or for your favorite person, be sure to check out Hell Yeah Voodoo Dolls. You can find them at hellyahvoodoodolls.com, where you can also find some info on the 4,000 square foot haunted Victorian manor that they're renovating. Shop Hell Yeah Voodoo Dolls today for your spooky needs.
Darkcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
Trigger warning. This episode contains themes of sexual assault on a minor, rape, and attempted suicide. Listener discretion is advised. Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of the Freaky as Fuck podcast. My name is Sarai, and this is part one of my two-part deep dive on convicted Colorado serial killer Scott Kimball. He is responsible for the murders of 4 known victims. However, he is suspected of killing as many as 21 individuals. Scott Lee Kimball was born on September 21st, 1966, in Boulder, Colorado. He withdrew from school during his freshman year at Centaurus High School. He was the quiet kid, not very popular, and kept to himself most of the time. In 1976, his parents would divorce, and this would have a drastic impact on 10-year-old Scott. This is when he begins spending most of his time at his grandmother's trailer, and it's here that he meets 41-year-old Theodore Payton. Payton would often drive Kimball to his cabin in Nederland, and the two would pass the time playing video games and hanging out. But it wasn't long until Payton's real intentions started to become evident. The sexual abuse began with Payton masturbating in front of young Scott, and he often had him pose naked for pictures that he took on his Polaroid camera. As Kimball got older, the trips to the cabin would grow more sadistic in nature, eventually getting to the point that Payton was forcing Kimball to perform sex acts. Payton would tell Kimball that he would kill his father if he ever reported the abuse to anyone. In 1981, Kimball moved to Montana to live with his father and young brother, but the abuse would continue when he would come back to Colorado to visit, and it would go on for another 7 years. In October of 1989, 23-year-old Scott and his brother were out on a hunting trip in western Montana. Scott had just returned to the motel room, and while he was alone, he took his .30-30 rifle, placed the barrel to his forehead, and pulled the trigger. The bullet had glanced off his skull, but combined with the back blast of the shot, Scott would suffer from a tear in his forehead. He was left in critical condition and had to be hospitalized for several days after, but would ultimately survive the attempt. He would never be the same person again. His cousin had explained that it seemed that Scott had completely lost his conscience at the time. Kimball would be left with a scar on his forehead to forever remind him of the abuse he endured as a young child. After his recovery, Kimball and several other young men would report Theodore Payton to Boulder police for sexual abuse, launching an investigation. Payton would be found guilty on 6 counts of sexual assault on a child and would spend 5 years, 3 months, and 2 weeks in prison, before being released on October 6, 1996. In a letter to the court, Kimball stated that Payton had denied him the right to a normal, healthy, and innocent childhood. and this abuse had affected him for the rest of his life. Kimball's mother would later tell police that he, quote, blames everything on the abuse. While living in Montana, Scott would make another attempt at attending high school before, again, dropping out, this time during his senior year. After high school, he drifted from job to job and would be married and divorced twice before he was 30 years old. In June of 1988, Scott would land his first felony offense at the age of 21. He wrote about $1,000 off in bad checks at a number of motel rooms in Beaverhead County in Montana. His 3-year sentence would wind up getting deferred, but it wasn't long until he found himself in the same situation in Missoula County just 4 months later. But because this crime occurred in a different county and under another jurisdiction, his 2-year sentence for this felony was also deferred. October 1988, Scott is arrested for breaking into 2 homes in Bloomfield, Colorado, where he'd stolen a fishing pole, 2 rifles, a shotgun, golf clubs, and tools. In March 1989, he would be convicted on 1 count of attempted theft in the same county. He's sentenced to 1 year of unsupervised probation and was ordered to pay $232 in restitution.
If you like all things spooky, then check out A Spooky Tales, hosted by us, Christina
and MJ, where we talk about all things spooky, like paranormal stories, haunted places, myths, and legends,
with a focus on Latin America.
There are new episodes every Friday.
Listen on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts, as well as aspookytales.com.
Stay spooky!
Autumn's Oddities is a strange and unusual podcast made by the strange and unusual, me, Autumn Gruby. Each week, I'll be taking you through some of the creepiest cases true crime has to offer. It won't only be true crime, I'll also be covering cryptids, haunted places, haunted things, and the true stories that inspired horror movies. Listen every Monday and Friday for new episodes. And remember, if it's creepy and weird, you'll find it here.
His second wife, Larissa Hentz, once stated that they had process servers showing up at their home every other week to serve Kimball court documents, and that Scott always had some kind of excuse. It was never his fault. When he wasn't having run-ins with the law, he was running from individuals whom he cheated and scammed. Scott and Larissa relocated themselves and their 2 sons to a home in Spokane, Washington, where Scott got a job in the timber business and pulled a number of logging scams. He'd also swindled money from their dentist and the church that the family attended. The 2 would wind up getting a divorce in 1997. In December 1999, Larissa Hentz would report Scott to the Spokane, Washington police for kidnapping her at gunpoint, raping her, and forcing her to drive him and their 2 sons to Montana. Authorities, however, are unable to make an arrest due to a lack of evidence. The Spokane police launched another investigation on Kimball for 3 counts of check forgery, and he was sentenced to prison in 2000 after the revocation of one of his suspended sentences from 1988. He got a job working as a cashier at a gas station after he was sent to a pre-release prison center. He would work his shift and then would be brought back to the prison once that shift was completed. During one of his shifts in July of 2001, Kimball just so happened to be working alone that day and decided to take the opportunity to steal $677 from the store register and to go on the run in a truck that he had also stolen. Authorities in Lewis and Clark County, Montana, would issue a warrant for Kimball on felony escape charges. Scott is able to escape arrest and finds his way to Alaska, where he assumes the name of his younger brother, Brett Kimball. He's somehow able to avoid getting caught by police for several months, and during this time, he meets a woman named Catherine Curtis, whom he winds up getting engaged to. That November, Scott writes up to $25,000 in bad checks under Brett's name, and it isn't long until Alaskan authorities begin to notice this suspicious activity. Kimball is once again arrested, this time by Alaskan police, while staying at a hotel in Cordova with his then-fiancée, Catherine. Authorities were able to recover $11,300 in $100 bills in the hotel room they were staying in. By this time, Scott Kimball had accumulated a stack of warrants against him, so he thought now would be a good time to make himself useful. While he was in prison, Kimball had told his fellow inmates that he was a murder-for-hire hitman. This, as we know, was not true. However, it gave prisoners the sense that they could trust him. He reports to the FBI that his cellmate, Arnold Flower, and his girlfriend, Samsung Kan Samfu, asked Kimball to assist in the killings of a federal judge, a prosecutor, and two witnesses who were involved in a case against him. Flowers and Kan Samfu were indicted by a grand jury the following month for murder for hire, witness tampering, and attempted murder of federal officials. In October 2001, Assistant U.S. Attorney and federal prosecutor Tom Wills is shot dead in Seattle. The assailant had fired through Wills' basement window while he was in there working. The murder goes unsolved. In February 2003, while still being held in the Anchorage prison, Kimball again offers information to the FBI on the then unsolved murder of Tom Wills. At this point, Kimball had gained the trust of the FBI, and in June 2002, he's transferred to FCI Englewood Prison in Colorado. While attending the prison, Scott claimed that his cellmate, Steve Ennis, was conspiring to take out a hit on a drug dealer. Ennis had asked Kimball to carry out this hit and had claimed that his girlfriend, Jennifer Markham, would help. His outstanding warrants are overlooked, and after spending 6 months at Englewood Prison, Scott Kimball is released as a paid FBI informant. He's given the name of Joe Scott and is told to keep an eye on Markham. Authorities in Missoula County, Montana, were upset at the decision to release Kimball. Lewis and Clark County Attorney Leo Gallagher had previously requested that Kimball be extradited back to Missoula County for prosecution on the theft and escape charges, but the request was ultimately ignored. This will conclude part one of this two-part series on Scott Lee Kimball. Next week, for part two, we will uncover the vicious crimes Scott committed while roaming the streets of Colorado as an official FBI informant. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave a 5-star rating and review on whatever platform you're listening to us on. Check me out on Twitter and Instagram. You can find me at FreakyAFPod, or send me an email at freakyafpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for sticking that out with me to the end, and I hope to see you here next time for part two. Till then, stay spooky.